Session number 13577, reel number 3.
When we got to New York, we were docked alongside the Normandy, which was on its side. If you remember, the Normandy caught fire from sabotage in New York Harbor, and so much water was pumped into it, it fell on its side. Anyway, we had a bit of trouble trying to get off the boat, but eventually we did, and had a good time in New York for a few hours.
The squadron were still all together, were they?
No, we were then separated. Jeff, we were just 50 pilots, 50 navigators. This was no longer, I no longer had a squadron at all. The idea was to send us somewhere in America for an aircraft. Nobody seemed to know where. The British Embassy didn't know either. So we eventually went to Dorval at Montreal in Canada by train. Quite a lovely journey that was. Took us about 36 hours, I think, by train. At Dorval, they still didn't know anything about us, and decided we could go on three weeks leave. At least we could get some Canadian money or American money. We had plenty of pound notes on us, but no currency which we could use. And we were given railway tickets and 3 weeks' pay. Told we'd be back in 3 weeks' time. I went to see my half-brother, who was 15 years older than me, and I hadn't seen since I was 8 years old. We eventually returned to England by ship in convoy, and by then it was September 1942. I was soon sent to Upper Heyford in Oxfordshire, a 16 OTU, as a navigation instructor. It was evident that by now that Bomber Command had been formed under Butch Harris, navigation was poor and resulted in heavy losses. And we were classed as having vast experience in navigation, and I was immediately commissioned, but had to wait 3 months, 6 months for my papers to catch up with me before I was actually in officer uniform.
What kind of navigation techniques were you teaching?
Well, just straightforward, our own experiences in the main and our own methods that we used.
What kind of lessons particularly were you trying to impress on them?
Oh, confidence in their own calculations, how to draw vectors on their Mercator chart in a way which they could easily recognize, and it was soon after this, of course, that I turned out to be a natural instructor, and there was a secret gadget sent to us under armed guard, and my CO sent to me, go and see what that silly bloody thing is there and there. And of course it was G, codename G. And it was so simple, I don't know why it was never invented before. It was based on pure mathematics. It was just a matter of how you use the machine that was usefulness as far as navigation was concerned. You could plot a position within 50 yards with this, and it could be used within 300 miles from the Midlands. In a couple of months, it was in general use throughout the Air Force, and it improved the efficiency of the navigation 100%. It meant that as aircraft flew out of England, they could plot their position accurately with the G, and we instituted a system of plotting a position every 10 minutes and drawing a vector. In this way, the 10-minute vector gave them their wind speed and direction, and by just looking at their chart, they could see which way the wind was going all the way on their journey. And this improved the navigation to an enormous degree. And before that, of course, many aircraft were lost because of bad navigation. It was well known that aircraft were flying up the North Sea thinking they were over England, going north over the North Sea, and ran out of petrol. And nothing anyone could do about it. Anyway, there was another radar gadget which was called H2S, which sent a radar signal from the aircraft down to the ground and back to the aircraft. This picked out rivers, towns, and coastlines. The signal seemed to disappear altogether in water, and as it hit solid towns, it came back to the aircraft. The ordinary ground came back as a sort of much lower mush than over towns, so you could recognise from say 12,000-13,000 feet the shape of a town. And rivers, of course, were easily seen, and coastlines. This was a great help when they got to Germany, of course, and bombing the target. Now, both the G and the H2S are still in use today in ordinary aircraft, ordinary ordinary flights from anywhere in the country. It's done in a much more sophisticated manner now. Of course, it's got it's improvements. All they have to do is press a button now, and it gives them the latitude and longitude. We had to work it out on the chart. And the H2S, of course, is much better because the modern aircraft flies at 30,000 feet, whereas we could only fly at 15,000 to 20,000 feet. So it gives them a much larger area to look at. Well, I spent a long time at about nearly three years, I think, at Upper Heyford. And
did you have Obo there as well?
No. Obo was a different system. That was in used by mosquitoes mainly. That was sending a signal which was operated really from the ground. The Obo pointed towards the target. And when the aircraft was over the target, it gave the aircraft permission to drop its bombs. That was very good, actually. It was very accurate. And I think Hitler wondered what had hit him with those. I don't think he ever found out what it was till the end of the war.
Sorry, you were saying you were 3 years approximately.
Oh, at 3 years at Upper Heyford. Yes, and I suppose I was getting too good at the job, but they weren't going to let me go. Anyway, I finally persuaded them to let me do a second tour, and I was sent as the Squadron Navigation Officer, 106 Squadron at Metheringham in Lincolnshire.
Apparently you arrived there in December 44.
That's right. That's December 44, that's right.
Why did you want to leave the safety of a training job for more operations?
Well, I felt I had more to do, and I wanted the experience as well. I hadn't flown in Lancasters. At Upper Heyford, we were still in Wellingtons for training. And also, I got several friends that I'd met who I knew were at Metheringham, and I managed to wangle my way into Metheringham. I knew that the current Squadron Navigation Officer was due to be tour expired, and I managed to get his job.
Where is Metheringham?
It's about 10 miles south of Lincoln. It's not far from Coningsby, where the 617 Pathfinders were. Now, 106 Squadron was a backup squadron to 617. And I flew with the B-Flight Commander, Arthur Barden. Sadly, he passed away in 1990, age 77. We done several raids in Germany within Lancasters. The opposition was far less by that time. The German night fighters were running out of petrol, and they were also being attacked badly by the Russians.
What did you feel about flying the Lancaster?
Oh, it's a lovely aircraft, and a beautiful aircraft to fly. There was one trip which was rather dramatic as far as I was concerned. It was to Stettin. It's a Polish port in the Baltic. It's now been renamed.
Szczecin.
Stettin, that's right. It's been renamed to another name now. Our route was to go to the north of Denmark, then fly south down the Skagerrak between Denmark and Sweden. Lovely to see the lights of Malmö as we passed by. And we were to return the same way. Anyway, I was then just purely navigation. We had a bombing man with us as well. Now, he was in charge of bombs. Bombing got more sophisticated in those days, with the various types of bombs and the methods and the machinery to use in the aircraft. And it became a bomb aimer's prerogative to study this, and also to study the targets and the bombing sites were also more sophisticated. It left me with pure navigation. Of course, we had G and H2S, which was no problem as far as getting correct positions was concerned. Anyway, over the target, we got caught in searchlights, and there was some heavy flak. And when we got clear, our starboard engine failed. There was fortunately enough puff in it to feather the propeller. That's to stop it windmilling in the wind. Stettin's a long way from home. I took immediate note of the course to fly to Sweden in case another engine went. We'd never got back home on two. Anyway, the other three engines seemed to be all right. And the next question was, have we got enough petrol to get back home? And we decided, instead of going on the long route back, going back over, going north and round Denmark again, the only way of getting there would be to fly straight home across the south of Denmark. So I set a course. We were then at 14,000 feet, and Arthur put the aircraft into a gentle glide to conserve the petrol. The engineer had to juggle his petrol around from one tank to another, which he could do. And Arthur had quite a tough job on, because it meant he'd got to keep right rudder going to keep the aircraft going in a straight line. Well, by the time we got over Denmark, we were down to 2,000 feet, and hopefully too low for the German radar to pick us up. And we decided we must maintain radio silence for the German Junkers 88 night fighters had a nasty habit of listening for damaged stragglers, and anyway, we arrived back home without any problems, about half an hour late, and next day when we landed, we were told we had 10 minutes petrol left.
Do you know the date of that?
Yes, it was. I can tell you, I can get you the date. Yes. Early February, anyway. January. Late January. Yes, it was 13th of January. I've got it down here, yes. 13th of January, that was. On the 13th of February, I took part in that controversial raid on Dresden. As navigation officer, I was responsible for the briefing of our squadron, and Winston Churchill had already expressed his sincere regret at having to do this raid. It was at the request of the Russians that we'd done it. They told us that the German army was retreating to the point to the north of Dresden, the marshalling guards there, ready to form for a counterattack. The Met Office reported an intense low to the east of Dresden, and this would give strong north winds over the city. And we always like to bomb against the wind, if possible. It was far more accurate for bombing to bomb into wind in a straight line if it was possible. And most of the bomb aimers set up their bomb sites before they go, knowing what the wind is likely to be, and then make the slight adjustments afterwards. Anyway, we were detailed to back up the Pathfinder markers, turn around and drop our bombs. We led 300 bombers at midnight, and I was quite satisfied that our markers were on the right place and our bombs went to the right place, because I could tell where we were by my H2S. That's the thing that looked at the map of the ground, more or less. It was 4 hours since this weather forecast. It took us 4 hours to get to Dresden, and 4 hours is a long time for the weather. And it was quite obvious to me that the low had intensified considerably, and the north wind was considerably heavier than they'd forecast. And the follow-up raid from the main squadron was 400 aircraft, which came 3 hours afterwards. And it was obvious that their markers got caught in this strong north wind, and also the bombs that they dropped were caught in the north wind, this strong wind, and the bombs dropped, unfortunately, in the northern part of the city and set it alight. And of course, with the north wind blowing as it was, the firestorm destroyed the complete city. That was a great shame.
What do you mean when you say that you had to back up the Pathfinder markers?
Well, we had markers as well. They dropped their markers first. And we were then told a particular colour from the marker who was 2,000 feet to see where the target was.
But you were a Pathfinder?
Yeah, we weren't technically a Pathfinder squadron, but we always flew to back up 617 or 57 of both Pathfinder squadrons from Coningsby.
But why was it necessary to have two lots of markers?
Well, because the markers fade out. I don't know how long they last, about 20 minutes, 15-20 minutes. So it means you've got to keep backing them up in order to keep the target marked.
Did you have any qualms about the Dresden raid?
Not really, no. No, not really. The war was obviously coming to an end. And I really think that raid really made the Germans start to think about surrendering. And of course they did a few weeks afterwards, didn't they? Wasn't long after. That was the 13th of February. It was about the 20th of April, eh?
But presumably you didn't see the main weight of bombs fall on Dresden.
No, I didn't. We were on our way home.
Was there much enemy opposition over Dresden?
No, there wasn't. Bit of anti-aircraft fire, but nothing else. Some aircraft were lost, I don't know why. After that raid, our targets were then proper oil, mainly oil targets and submarine bases. After about 48 raids on the enemy, I was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, and I completed about 55 raids by the end of the war. On April the 25th, High Command had declared ceasefire at midnight. And early that morning, Arthur and I were called to the operations room. There were three submarines in a fjord just north of Oslo. And we were asked if we could drop some mines at the entrance to this fjord to stop the submarines getting out. This was to be done before midnight. Well, we had magnetic mines at Motheringham, and all this had never been done before. So I consulted the bombing leader and another navigation officer on what methods I would use, and we decided I could bomb it on my H2S, drop the bombs on my H2S, and take vectors from various points at the entrance of this fjord off my H2S, which would give me an aiming point. It meant these mines had to be dropped at about 3 second intervals, so it got a line right across the entrance to the fjord. It was about 1,000 yards across this fjord. That was no problem. You know, I got the method I got down and I was quite satisfied with what I had to do. And the problem came when we got to the aircraft, one of the engines wouldn't go. So all this gear had to be whipped out there smartly and put into another aircraft. These magnetic mines were such that once they were primed, nothing they could do about it. They had to be taken away. If we couldn't drop them in their places, we had to either drop them in very deep sea or get them dropped into a mine, one of these quarries, so that they could be exploded there. There was no way of undoing the mechanism on a magnetic mine once it was set. Anyway, it meant that we were a good 30 or 40 minutes late in taking off. We had to get permission from the group captain of the airfield, because he was then in charge of the thing. It was his duty to say whether we should scrub or go on. Anyway, I looked at the chart and the route. I said, well, we can cut off 2 or 3 minutes by taking a different route. And Arthur Barden said, well, the aircraft we're going in, I know, is a faster aircraft. Aircraft did vary a bit, like cars are today. They vary in their performance. He said, I think I can get another 5 knots out of this one. And so the group captain said, right, okay, press on. And we got to the target all right. And it was cloud over the target, but that didn't worry me because I had my H2S to see the target. And I had to drop these things at about 5,000 feet. And the parachute opened at about 1,000 feet. It was all arranged on the ground beforehand that this parachute would open at 1,000 feet, or after so many seconds. All very sophisticated stuff. Everything else went according to plan. In fact, the last mine I dropped was at 23:59 on the 25th before the ceasefire, and we are officially credited with dropping the last things in anger. After that, we were very happy to fly to Germany to bring back our own prisoners of war, returning them to England. That was taking place before the actual signing of the surrender, and immediately afterwards. And also parts of our squadron done the Operation Manna, which was dropping food to the Dutch people who had been left. We couldn't get at them quick enough, really, to give them food, so we dropped them food by parachute.
Did you do that yourself?
No, not myself. I wasn't on that. I was on picking up prisoners of war. Other parts of the squadron were doing that.
Where did you pick the POWs up from?
Oh, I picked them up, some from Chauvincourt in France, which were brought in by the Americans with Dakotas, and a lot more from Reiner in